I'd like to welcome everybody to the lunch. Thanks for coming. I want to introduce our speaker. I'm Mark Spindelman, an associate professor here at the College of Law. Welcome to all of our guests, including our law students. Charlie Savage is a graduate of Harvard College. He began his career writing about local and state government and politics in Florida for the Miami Herald. In 2003, after receiving a master's degree from Yale Law School, he moved to Washington and joined the staff of the Boston Globe. His portfolio at the Globe includes not only the Supreme Court, but also the Justice Department and the Department of Homeland Security, with a special focus on 9/11 issues, such as detention and interrogation policy. At the moment, Charlie is on leave from the Globe to write a book about executive power issues for Little Brown, scheduled to be published in the fall of 2007. A little bit more background for those of you who missed it. Earlier this year, Charlie wrote a series of articles about President Bush's use of signing statements. This work helped to launch a national conversation, including a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing and an American Bar Association investigation, not to mention a little pushback from Larry Tribe, the Karl Loeb University professor at Harvard Law School, a moderately well-known figure in constitutional circles. Though Charlie may be one of the youngest Supreme Court reporters in the current Supreme Court pool, I think it's fair to say he's not, or certainly is no longer, simply a rising star. But whatever we call him, he's clearly a player in some of the most important political and legal, including constitutional, debates of our times. We're lucky to have him here to talk about some of his work. Please join me in welcoming Charlie Savage.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm very honored to be here. I guess what I'm going to do is talk for 15 or 20 minutes about the issue of signing statements, which is what I've spent so much of my time this past year trying to figure out and explain to other people. And then we'll have some questions later on, and hopefully that'll be the bulk of the presentation, because I'm more comfortable in a give and take. What I'll do is I'll describe signing statements, kind of what they are. I'll talk about the current administration's use of signing statements to claim the right to disobey laws that it has signed. And I'll talk about the discovery of this previously obscure issue, how it unfolded, and some of the controversies over what exactly the problem is, if there is a problem, and what the solution to that might be, about which there is some disagreement. So up until a year ago, very few people had even heard of a signing statement. And now law textbooks are being rewritten to include discussion of them, at least already if those who have purchased the 2006 supplement to the Processes of Constitutional Decision-Making have some academic discussion of what this is. A signing statement is an official document which is issued by the president on the day he signs a law. And it is not a proclamation in which he lauds what a great law this is and praises Congress for their good work and so forth. He issues those as well, and a lot of attention is put on those. A signing statement, by contrast, is a very technical legal document which, although it is a public document, is not intended for public consumption, is not given a lot of attention, and until about a year ago, very few people even knew that they existed. A signing statement contains the president's legal interpretation of the bill he's just signed into law and instructions to the executive branch bureaucracy about how they are to implement this law now that it's on the books. Very often, especially in this administration, signing statements have been used to declare that parts of the bill are unconstitutional in the eyes of the president. Almost always, these are parts of the bill which place restrictions or requirements on the executive branch of government. And in a way that, especially in the current administration's view, goes beyond the ability of Congress to regulate and set rules for how the government is to work. It intrudes on the inherent executive powers of the president. And so when you sign a bill like this, if you're the president and you want to call attention to these sections and essentially nullify them, you tell the executive branch that they will construe Section X, which purports to require the Inspector General of the Justice Department to give a report to Congress periodically in light of the president's powers as head of the executive branch, head of the unitary executive branch, sometimes as commander-in-chief, and so on. So These kinds of statements have been issued going back to the 19th century, first around the 1830s, but they were exceedingly rare until the mid-1980s, when the Mies Justice Department during the Reagan administration seized upon them as a way to expand executive power. Their primary interest, when you go back and read the memos from the 1985-86 era, many of which first became available last year during the John Roberts and then Sam Alito nominations, their primary focus was on improving the role or expanding the role of the executive branch in later disputes over how to interpret legislation. When the courts are called upon to figure out what an ambiguous provision of law means, they look to the legislative history, what Congress had said during the debates about the bill when they were crafting the legislation, for insight into what this is supposed to mean. And the Mies Justice Department's insight was, or argument was, the president has to sign the bill. He's a participant in this too, so his interpretation ought also to be important. Let's issue signing statements and then convince the courts that what the president thought at the time of signing was just as important as what Congress thought at the time of crafting. And so that's when signing statements started to be issued more frequently. President Bush the First continued the practice. President Clinton continued the practice. This is not a partisan issue. This is an executive branch power issue. The current administration, however, has taken that already escalating practice to unprecedented levels. When you add up the number of statutes, by which I mean bill sections or specific unique provisions that have been challenged by all previous presidents from George Washington through Bill Clinton, and combine them, you get about 600 laws. When you add up the bill sections which have been challenged by the Bush-Cheney administration in the first 6 years of office, you get more than 800 laws. So in the last eight years, this administration has challenged more laws than all previous presidents in American history combined. Moreover, since those mid-1980s Mies Justice Department strategy memos, the purpose of a signing statement has mutated. The laws that are being challenged today are no longer ambiguous statutes which are likely to come before a court and require interpretation. Rather, they are almost exclusively laws that place restrictions on how the president can run the government or requirements on what he must do with the government. Famously, under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 of the Constitution, Congress has the power to make all rules and all regulations for how the government is to be run. But this administration has an extremely aggressive view of executive power, which basically discounts that section of the Constitution, and which instead says that the president has vast inherent powers, which are unspecified but contained in the clause, the executive power is invested in a president. And under the unitary executive theory, which was developed during the Mies Justice Department and has perhaps reached fruition now in this administration, Congress cannot give any independence to lower executive branch officials or set requirements for them to act beyond the will of the president. The president has total control over the government, and the president has vast inherent powers, which combined, these two concepts, put the government largely beyond the reach of Congress to be regulated, a shift of power to the Oval Office. And so, working with these theories, the administration has systematically attacked legislation that President Bush has signed into law over the last 6 years, looked for every provision that could restrain the president's authority as he sees it under his interpretation of the Constitution, which is not a widely supported view of the Constitution, and has gone forth. And at the same time, President Bush has virtually abandoned the mechanism that the Constitution gives him for dealing with legislation that he believes is unconstitutional. That is the veto power, which of course is a limited veto power. It's limited by two ways. First of all, it requires the president to veto an entire legislative package in its entirety, rather than a line item that allows him to keep what he wants and get rid of what he doesn't like. And second, it allows Congress to check that authority by overriding the veto with a two-thirds vote in either house. By instead simply declaring that Section X or Section Y is unconstitutional and need not be obeyed as written, this administration and those of you signing statements generally are essentially able to have a unilateral final word on what their authority is and gives Congress no chance to override those judgments. So this has been going on since the beginning of this administration, but very few people were paying attention to it. There was some academic work here in Ohio with Christopher Kelly, who's at Miami University of Ohio, and there was some academic work at Portland State University on this. But it was receiving no attention, really. Nothing in Congress, certainly nothing in the press. And then last December 30th, following a year-long fight with Senator John McCain over whether the United States government could use cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against detainees held by the CIA, essentially, abroad, Congress passed overwhelmingly in both houses what is simply referred to as the McCain Amendment or the torture ban. President Bush had fought against this. Vice President Cheney had gone to Congress to lobby lawmakers personally to give an exemption to the CIA. Bush had threatened to use what would then have been his first veto against the bill, but Republicans and Democrats alike came together at the end and said, no, the United States is not going to engage in these practices as a matter of moral principle, and passed it by such overwhelming majorities in both chambers that a veto would have been overridden. President Bush called Senator McCain as well as Senator Warner into the White House, called the cameras in to film him shaking their hands. He congratulated them. He said he was going to accept this restriction, even though he had previously opposed it. And that was the image that went out to the country and to the world. But when President Bush signed the bill that contained the torture ban on December 30th, 2005, he, that evening, around 8 or 9 p.m., put out a signing statement which said, among other things, that he had the power as commander-in-chief to bypass that ban if he decided that using torture or techniques approaching torture was necessary to prevent a terrorist attack, in his judgment. Essentially, in other words, he would follow the ban when he wanted to, and he would not follow it when he didn't want to. He was not bound to obey it whether or not he liked it. And I wrote the first article in the mainstream press about that signing statement. It was brought to my attention, however, credit where credit is due, by a blog entry by Martin Lederman, who is a professor at Georgetown University. And there was this thunderstorm. The Republicans who had been involved in crafting that bill said, what are you talking about? You know, John McCain, John Warner, Lindsey Graham put out angry statements saying, we're going to, you know, you understand that you asked for a waiver power and we didn't give it to you. We considered it and rejected it, so we're going to hold you to this. And then it sort of died down again. And then in March, after a long fight over the reauthorization to the USA Patriot Act, Congress finally reauthorized that controversial bill. And to overcome a filibuster against it, the bill was rewritten to include a lot of new oversight provisions. The FBI and the rest of the Justice Department had to keep careful track of how often it was using these new surveillance powers on domestic soil. They had to give that information to congressional oversight committees by certain dates, and only on condition of those oversight provisions being written into the law was the filibuster dropped and Congress agreed to let the law essentially become permanent, with a few other exceptions that are still sunsetted. Anyway, once again, Bush put a signing statement on that bill. He signed it into law and then said, all these oversight provisions, I can withhold this information if I want to. I have vast powers, not just if it's national security secrets, but if I decide that the information that this law says Congress has to be given would interfere with executive branch operations, we can withhold it, a long list. And that also caused a lot of consternation. I wrote the first article about that as well, and then I went and back and spent several weeks reading and deciphering and deconstructing all the signing statements that Bush had been issuing since 2001, looking at the bill sections identified, looking up those sections, what is this he's saying, what is this he's saying he doesn't have to do. And in late April, I wrote this very long article, which got a lot of attention, basically specifying just how vast this practice had become and laying out many of the laws. It went far beyond the torture ban and the Patriot Act. It was any time Congress had written anything into a law that had something to do with affirmative action, he had said that he basically challenged that. Any time the Congress had written something saying, give us a report on X or give us a report on Y, we need to be able to form our constitutional role by getting information about what the government is doing, he had said he could withhold that information. Anytime Congress had issued rules and regulations for the military, such as after the Abu Ghraib incident, no longer can military contractors be used in military prisons overseas. They have to be actually uniformed people because, of course, outsourced contractors had been part of that torture scandal from the Kaki company. Bush had said, I'm the commander-in-chief. I decide how our military prisons are run, and so forth and so on. As I said before, at that point it was about 750 laws, already more than all previous presidents combined, and the practice has continued since. So, following these articles, the Senate Judiciary Committee, led by Arnold Inspector, who's a moderate Republican, held hearings on the practice, and Inspector accused the administration of trying to cherry-pick the laws that he wanted to obey and not. The administration countered with the argument that this practice had a long history, other presidents had done it, and it was necessary because Congress lumps so many different provisions or so many different kinds of laws into a single bill that it's just impractical to veto it. You need the funding bill for the military. You can't veto it because it's got, you know, one provision in there you don't like. So this is a way to get around that dilemma. The American Bar Association convened a task force of law school professors and retired officials. It was bipartisan, had Republicans as well as Democrats. And they looked at the problem, and they decided that the problem was not the legal claims that Bush was making in his signing statements per se, but rather the entire mechanism of signing statements. And what is this? This is not in the Constitution. A president can only sign a bill and then enforce it in its entirety, or he can veto it. That's what he can do. And you've invented this sort of line item veto that's absolute and override proof, and it's gradually grown and that's gone out of control, and we have this tipping point where we're paying attention to it. All of this needs to be rolled back. No president can be doing this, not Bill Clinton, not George Bush, not whoever replaces George Bush. And the Bar Association voted to endorse that finding. There are other people who think, no, signing statements are fine in and of themselves. The problem is the legal claims that this administration is advancing in its statements because they're radical, they're unsupported, they're not mainstream interpretations of the Constitution. If you have a mainstream interpretation, the Supreme Court's already said something is illegal or is unconstitutional, it's fine to sign a bill and then just note that there's a problem down here. But it's when you use these mechanisms to push a view that people don't think is actually true, that's the problem. A group of Democrats who are, for the most part, who are associated with the executive branch, Clinton administration, Office of Legal Counsel attorneys have adopted that view, for example, as did Lawrence Tribe, as you recently mentioned. So we have a dispute over whether the problem is the mechanism itself, generically speaking, or the problem is just the sort of bad faith use of the mechanism to push a legal agenda that mainstream scholars reject. Or, of course, there's the administration's view, which is there is no problem, this is all perfectly fine, and nothing to see here, folks. So that's the state of play today. And I guess this is the stage now where there's some discussion, and then I'll come back, and I'd be happy to take questions and talk about it some more. So thank you.
All right, thanks. Hopefully you've had enough time now to discuss amongst yourselves Charlie's introduction to the subject, and I'd like to bring him back now to field some questions from you. Jim.
First of all, terrific work. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you. Or at least we have the right not to obey them.
Going back as far as 2001, has there been a moment at which disobedience or reserved right has been challenged in the courts? And if not, why do you think not? And if so, what has happened and what do you think might happen when these begin to be challenged, when some of the more recent visible ones begin to be challenged?
Well, they haven't been challenged, and the reason is the types of separation of powers claims here, especially when coupled to a national security context, when everything is secret, make it very hard for these sorts of legal issues to get before the courts. You know, the Congress says you shall not torture ever under any circumstances anywhere in the world. And Bush says, but yes, I can if I want to. But is he? And if he is, you know, because who knows what's happening in some secret overseas prison somewhere? No one knows. And even if it did become apparent that, you know, detainee X was, you know, being treated in violation of that law, in detainee X is a foreign citizen, not on U.S. soil. This is not, therefore, detainee X is not within the jurisdiction of federal courts. And so we don't know what's happening, and typically, in that case, the person, you know, there's just no way for the courts to consider such a claim. Now, Arlen Specter, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, has proposed a solution to this dilemma. He has said he has introduced a bill, which obviously is not going to get passed by this Congress, which is now in recess, probably wouldn't have been passed anyway, which would confer upon Congress as an institution the power to sue the president over the legal claims being made in his signing statements, under the somewhat novel theory that Congress as an institution is harmed when a law that it writes is sort of line item vetoed in a way that it cannot override, and therefore this law would give Congress the institutional standing as a body to put the question before the courts. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why, even if that were passed, it's questionable whether a court would actually say, yes, we have standing to hear this. There's this actual case or controversy with a national victim. But that's one approach that's been suggested as a way of getting around that. But in general, just the separation courts in general are also just very reluctant to get involved in disputes between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It's one of the trickiest areas in American constitutional law. And so that's why signing statements that do not involve individual victims who are Americans on U.S. soil that are identifiable are not likely to get before the courts in the past or in the future. And that's why they become sort of a final word on one's own powers when a president issues them.
Doug Berman, we should probably repeat the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll repeat the question from now on.
Why can we be pleased with the president?
The question is, aren't signing statements good because at least it's a measure of transparency? the public and the Congress, if they know to look at them, can get some sense of what's happening. Right? The president could still not enforce the, or obey these laws and just do it secretly and no one would know. And that's absolutely true. And that's one of that's one of the arguments advanced by the Clinton-era Office of Legal Counsel attorneys who criticized the American Bar Association's call for an end to signing statements. They said, the problem is not the signing statements. Signing statements in and of themselves are a good thing because at least we can know, you know, how they're interpreting these laws. The problem, in their view, the problem is just these sort of unsupported legal theories that are being contained in the signing statements. And that's what we ought to be talking about. In the rebuttal from the ABA position is this is something I didn't raise in my earlier remarks when we were talking about it over here is, you know, one of the great difficulties of this is from a constitutional matter is, does a president have the power not to enforce or obey a law that's on the books? You know, if you get rid of signing statements in general, and presidents stop doing that and they start either vetoing it or enforcing it, new laws in their entirety, there's still the related problem of what does a president do with a law that he thinks is unconstitutional but was put on the books before he took office? For example, FISA, the warrant law from 1978, which this administration has declared essentially unconstitutional with its NSA program. The president doesn't have a chance to veto that, so doesn't he have the power to not enforce it? And this is, you know, the Constitution doesn't explicitly give the president the right to not enforce laws that he independently has decided are unconstitutional. It's a power that is sort of the executive branch has accreted unto itself over time. And in fact, only as recently as 1993 or 4 in the Clinton administration did the Office of Legal Counsel write a memo that really definitively said, yes, we can do this. The ABA wants to roll that back, too. The ABA is saying presidents just have to obey the law, even if they think it's unconstitutional, until such a time as the court says it's unconstitutional. So they would, even if you took away signing statements and it was done in secret, they would say presidents still ought not be circumventing laws, whether it's done in public or not. And that's just the way it is. But to get back to your question, yes, signing statements as a mechanism serve a positive role in transparency. That's true.
Steve?
Come back.
Steve?
That is also an excellent point. That reminds me of a conversation I had with a man, a law professor at Pepperdine University named Douglas Kamek, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Reagan administration when it was developing the unitary executive theory. And Douglas Kamek's position was that although he generally agrees with most, though not all, of the executive power theories being advanced by the current administration, he thinks that their prolific use of signing statements is not serving their client, the president, well, because it's needlessly picking fights with Congress instead of sort of saving the ammunition for when it really matters. And so he's become a critic of that. He thinks it could, in fact, provoke a pushback that would serve no one's interest. So.
Has pushed
The question is, what can Congress do to push back against this infringement of its own law-writing prerogatives if it had the political will to do so, which it obviously does not currently, but in some future hypothetical Congress? Well, there's a number of tools in Congress's toolbox. They can hold hearings and issue subpoenas and haul executive branch officials before them to explain themselves and put scrutiny on things. They can not confirm presidential nominees to show their displeasure. They can zero out funding for projects and programs that the White House is very interested in. And, of course, the biggest stake of all is impeachment, but that seems politically unlikely and probably unwise unless something really extreme was happening. But these are basically all the tools that Congress has had for the last 200 years whenever there's been a separation of powers dispute to make its displeasure known. But it needs the political will to do so. And what's one of the things that's interesting about what's been happening these last 6 years when there's been one-party control of government is that it's demonstrated a flaw in the Constitution as designed by our founders, who did not anticipate the rise of political parties in the manner in which they exist in current politics. The founders thought that we would have a strong system of separation of powers because the officials in each branch would be jealous of their own powers, and they would push back against encroachments from the other branches just out of their own self-interest, not because they believed in highfalutin principles, but just because, hey, that's mine, give it back. That system of self-interest working against self-interest in order to maintain the equilibrium between the separation of powers is eroded when you have one political party that controls multiple branches of Congress, because then their institutional self-interests come into conflict with their partisan interest in not embarrassing the president, for example, because when the president's approval ratings are low, Republicans, in this case, are likely to lose seats in Congress at the next election. And when the president's approval ratings are high, they're likely to gain seats. And so you don't want, in that case, if you're a member of Congress, you don't want to, you know, put too harsh a scrutiny on another branch because it could hurt you. Founders did not anticipate that, and that's has led to something of a breakdown in Congress performing its normal vigorous oversight and separation of power role the last several years. The question is, we were just looking about tools in Congress's toolbox to maintain its own constitutional prerogatives. Can't we look at the executive branch's lack of tools from dealing with Congress's habit of putting many different things into one bill and saying take it all or leave it all and so forth? And that explains the rise of signing statements. And that's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. You look at the memos and you look at how they've been used in concurrently speeches over the last 20 years from one administration after another. That's exactly what this was. This was an invention of a new tool to increase executive power or to push back against an increase of legislative power, depending on your point of view. It's just not a tool that's in the Constitution. And so the question is, if we as a society want the executive branch to have that tool, the ABA says, at least in its report, a constitutional amendment is necessary, whether that would take the form of a line item veto or which this has sort of become in a backdoor way or something else. That's the mechanism for giving the one branch an extra tool that it doesn't have in the Constitution. You don't just sort of invent it and say, here it is.
I think we'll take two more questions. One from Alan Deason.
I'm curious what you think that increasing the executive tools by means of something like line item veto
question is, if, from a policy perspective, what is the way to deal with this problem? Maybe instead of a line item veto or a signing statement, Congress ought to be restricted to only passing bills that are narrowly focused. So pass more shorter bills so that a president isn't forced to take X if he wants Y. And that certainly would be better for our government. I agree. If they would do that. They're not doing that, but they should.
Jim?
I guess I want to go back to the presidential toolbox and just so I'm clear on where you're coming from, there's nothing unconstitutional or even constitutionally suspect, I don't think, or questionable here, about
the question is the signing statements as envisioned by the Reagan administration, which were not aimed, at least initially, at taking out legislation that was clear but was just unconstitutional in the eye of the president, but was rather aimed at providing an interpretive gloss on legislation that was ambiguous and could, and then this other form of signing statement that, or that takes on legislation that is clear and doesn't need to be interpreted, but is just simply unconstitutional. And, you know, is the former, the interpretive kind, okay, and it's only the latter kind that's a problem? And the second question was, where does the Clinton administration fall into that evolution? Some people think that even the interpretive kind is at least ought not to be used in court. That's Arlen Specter's provision. I don't see why that's a bad thing. If something is genuinely ambiguous, the executive branch does need to interpret it in order to put it into force, and it seems totally appropriate for the president to say, this is my interpretation, and to do so in a publicly transparent manner. That's just my opinion. I don't think Arlen Specter agrees, but that's me. And yes, what gets troubling is the point where Congress's will was clear, the courts have not said that Congress can't do this, and the president is just sort of taking it out on his own initiative. The second part was, where did Clinton fall on this? Even, you know, this evolution, this mutation from the interpretive kind to the simply, I'm not going to obey X kind.